Welcome to the Circumference Podcast Series. I'm your host, Montana Ray, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Lauren Spinuti. Larry, by way of an introduction, would you please describe your mother tongue?
That's a difficult question for me because I'm the child of immigrants. I grew up hearing dialects of Italian. My mother's parents were from the south of Italy. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, emigrated to the U.S. from Foggia. And my maternal grandmother was essentially a mail-order bride. She was sent over. He chose her by a photo and sent her over. And they both spoke very broken English. So I would spend a lot of time, you know, there as a child and picked up a lot of Italian. But it was dialect. My father's parents were originally from Sicily, and they were brought to the U.S. at a very young age. So they spoke Sicilian, the Sicilian dialect, but they had much better English. And then, because, you know, I grew up in a working class, you know, neighborhood, I would hear varieties of working class English. But the other working class people I came in contact with may also have been children of immigrants. Mm-hmm. So there were Polish, there were Jews, there were Irish, and one of my uncles on my mother's side was Lebanese. His English was also quite unique. Again, another, you know, child of immigrants. So I would have to say that my mother tongue is very much a hybridized English.
And in your family, how is that defined against a kind of standard English?
Part of the hybridity comes from the kinds of aspirations that your parents visit upon you when they imagine what your future will be. And because I was the child of the first generation born in the U.S., my parents immediately distanced themselves from Italian, spoke it only to my grandparents, which means it was something only within the home. They did not speak a broken English. I mean, we could call it a working class dialect. You know, my father had a high school education, that was it. My mother was a high school dropout. And that, I think, was part of her aspiration for me. She was very concerned that I speak, you know, good English. It was very important for her. Called me Lawrence because she was enthralled with Laurence Olivier's dialect. You know, wow, when I heard this, you know, I couldn't imagine it. Although, you know, she didn't spell Lawrence with a U, she spelled it with a W, which struck me as a way of insinuating, you know, her own difference or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I still have to think about that, what that means. You know, I mean, I became an English major. I mean, talk about, you know, your parents visiting their aspirations on you. So I love to read and write also, and all the things that lead you, you know, to that kind of path. What I learned, of course, was a kind of academic discourse. I mean, to succeed, you had to, you know, write a standard English that was of a certain, you know, academic discourse, and that got me to graduate school.
So academic English is another sedimented layer in your English. What about Italian? When did you encounter literary or academic texts in Italian?
It was not until I was a doctoral candidate in English literature that I began studying standard Italian, Tuscan dialect. And, you know, immediately there was this sense of tremendous familiarity, of course. And certain things, you know, came more easily to me, I think, than in students with different backgrounds. Nonetheless, there is this, you know, hybridity, and I think that this has played into my thinking about translation, but also my translations.
How do you see your into English translations registering those hybridities?
I think that I gravitated toward, intuitively, toward a style that mixed, you know, current standard English with more stylistic peculiarities, depending on, you know, what the source text was, in this case, Italian. And I think eventually what happened, and but when I say eventually, I'm talking about, you know, after 5 book-length translations, after a mentorship with poet translators like Ruth Feldman and Brian Swan, and I was a kind of protege of William Weaver's, you know, the fiction translator. After all of that, I think I, you know, became aware, it was a slow process, how much translations were channeled into a very narrow form of the translating language. Mm-hmm. Not every translator, of course, you know, did this. I mean, Pound, I mean, the great poet translators did not do it. But even as the 20th century went on, poet translators, you know, edited out what linguists call non-standard forms. Mm-hmm. And what I came to regard as, you know, interesting. Interesting because they were in these so-called original compositions. And I became aware slowly of how translators were being held to a narrow range of the translating language. And that dovetailed, I guess, with my background, with my hybridity, and just opened things up.
You've translated now over 15 books, most of them from the Italian. What draws you to a translation project?
For me, that question of value is really complicated because value never resides simply in the work. Mm. There are millions of foreign writers who deserve to be translated, mm-hmm. who are valuable to some readers and some cultures in some sense. Mm-hmm. Every choice has a certain degree of, you know, the arbitrary about it. Mm-hmm. So for me, one of the questions always is with translation, how do I give a certain necessity to my choice of a source text?
And do you ever question your authority to determine which foreign texts are of value?
I have to say that, you know, I'm really sensitive to the issue that I think is implied, you know, in your question. And that is, you know, how could I be so presumptuous to, you know, exercise my sole judgment. But immediately I have to say, it's not simply me. I look at the choice, which is one of the most important steps in developing a translation project, the very choice of the source text for translation. I look at this as an interpretive act and try to make it, you know, with as much self-consciousness as possible.
And could you explain how the choice to translate a particular work is an interpretive act in regards to your most recently published translation project, Edward Hopper, the Ekphrastic Poetry written in Catalan by Ernest Fides?
So going to Fides, it was important that it was not written in Spanish, that it was written in Catalan, a language that is a minor language in Spain. The Generalitat of Catalunya likes to boast that there's some 12 million speakers of Catalan, but it's probably not the case. Mm-hmm. It's a minor language, relatively speaking, vis-a-vis Castilian. So one of the consequences of that is that, you know, Catalan writing has been excluded from translation. And there is relatively little. In recent memory, the heyday of English translations of Catalan was probably in the early 1980s. Late 1970s. And the person in this case was David Rosenthal, who did an enormous amount. There are problems with his translations, you know, people have pointed them out. But without Rosenthal, who did medieval text and did modern text, major writers and figures who were less known, Catalan would not have been in English mm-hmm. for us today. And it includes, you know, major figures like the novelist Mercè Rodoreda. He translated her major novel, which in Catalan is called La Plaça del Diamant. He translated it as The Time of the Doves. There are not really doves in the novel, they're pigeons, but he used the term doves. So the idea of a writer who was not simply working in a minor language, but a language that had been excluded from English, immediately attracted me. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, one of my main categories is to translate work that exposes a certain lack in English. And that can take a lot of different forms, but one form is just an exclusion, just a marginalization. The marginality of Catalan, you know, attracts me. The second thing, I think, with this is that I was hoping, and I think I was rewarded, that what Ferez offered was a take on not simply a canonical painter, but an American cultural icon who had created images, as we know, that are so indelible, they've colonized our imaginations, that he would give us a take that would make Hopper look different. So I was looking for mobilization of Hopper that would in some way question Hopper's status or the significance that he has for us through the ekphrasis. So that's how I was working. As the project developed, other issues came in, because we're translating here. The question of what kind of language the translator is going to use comes up right away. Ferez's Catalan is interesting. I mean, talk about hybridity. I mean, he samples all kinds of styles and discourses, a lot of non-standard things. I learned many, many colloquial expressions. It's very idiomatic, his Catalan. But also it's filled with jargon. That is always tempting to me. I tend to gravitate away from homogeneity, and I'm looking for things that will stretch me as a translator and will bend my English into weird and, I hope, beautiful new shapes.
Wonderful. I would love to hear one of your Ferez translations. Would you please read Compartment C, Car 293, 1938, from Edward Hopper?
Okay. Face stern, hair more or less blonde, eyes with an inward-looking glint, skin in the pink, wearing a stare till your bored attitude, in a black dress that hugged her breasts, and a pair of long legs in good working order. She looked real swell, sure enough. And independent, as the saying goes. The downtime on the train was just a ticket for stealing looks at her as she sat across the aisle, reading, poor kid, with such concentration that at dusk she completely missed the sun's last rays burning in the west, stuck to the limitless vault of the sky.
You're listening to the Circumference podcast series. That was Lawrence Finuti reading Compartment C, Car 293, 1938, from Edward Hopper. And here is Ernest Ferez reading the so-called original.
Rostre saber, cabells més o menys rossos, ulls amb una espurna d'introversió, cutis al pic de la vida, posat de besguipant-me fins que t'avorreixis, vestit negre que li estrenyi els pits i un joc de cames llargues i en plenes facultats. Era, i fa de bon dir, una dona atractiva i, en el sentit modern del mot, independent. Aquelles hores mortes del tren eren propícies per llançar-li mirades furtives a la dona que seia a l'altra banda del passadís. Llegia, la pobra, amb tanta concentració que a l'hora baixa li passà per alt que els últims raig del sol s'adherien encesos per l'oest a la volta sense límits del cel.
That was Ernest Ferez reading Compartment C, Car 293, 1938. Larry, could you tell me about the voice that Ferez creates for this ekphrastic poem and what opportunities that voice created for you as the translator?
The thing about the context that he creates is that it foregrounds the voyeurism in Hopper's paintings.
Absolutely.
And in this painting in particular. Right. So when you look at Hopper's paintings, you are, you know, given the male gaze, but it's invisible, okay? You are positioned in that gaze. What Ferez does is foregrounds that. So his whole relationship, the relationship between the poem and the painting, is interrogative. He makes you more self-conscious. It's not simply that. I mean, he characterizes this male voice in a way that is not quite favorable, we'll say. I mean, there's tremendous condescension here. In the Catalan, for instance, Ferez uses the word la pobra to describe the woman, and I translate it as poor kid instead of the poor woman or the poor girl, because I really wanted to get the condescension. She's reading, and that's beneath anything this guy could think about, right? So it's poor kid. I really increased the colloquialism, too, because I wanted to open up the whole sense that this is a working-class guy, not very educated, looks down his nose at a woman reading, especially a so-called independent woman, which is, in quotation marks, in the Catalan, and I retain that, of course, in the English. So I'm trying to build this image of this, you know, masculinist point of view, which I think is in the Catalan, but it's even more in the English. The view that we're getting in the Hopper painting is Hopper's. And the woman in the painting is Josephine Nivison, his wife, who posed for a lot of his things. And the whole perspective of the painting is at such an angle where he's, you know, at his easel. He's a very tall guy, Hopper, right? Over 6 foot. Looking down, you know, on this woman. So one of the things that I worked into the translation, but especially in this poem, was the language that Hopper himself used in his writing, in his interviews, in the few essays he wrote. But also Josephine Nivison's. I mean, they spoke a similar kind of, you know, dialect, vernacular American English. And it comes out here in a line like, "She looked real swell." The Catalan is standard Catalan. Era una dona atractiva, which could be translated as, "She was an attractive woman." Okay, that would be correct. It would be pretty close to the Catalan. I translated it as, "She looked real swell." I would argue this maintains an equivalence. Swell is attractive. But I got this from Hopper's a letter he had written. And in the back of the book, I put the quotation in. So in November of 1931, he wrote a letter to a friend who had written the first monograph on his painting. And in this, Hopper wrote, and I'm quoting here, "I think you did a swell job on me as a Puritan in the Whitney Museum book." So I worked in Hopper's lexicon. I created lists of words. I created a kind of, you know, Hopper glossary for my translation. It's period specific. Swell is an archaic word today, although you can still find it. You probably use it by people of a certain generation. But if I'm trying to do translations that expose certain lacks or that interrogate the receiving culture, make it more aware of its limitations and what it doesn't have, I'm also doing that with the language and trying to make readers more aware of the different registers of English, the distinctions between standard and non-standard, but also
private and public also.
Absolutely, bucking a certain discursive regime under which translators work. Copy editors are constantly, with translations in particular, removing non-standard forms. So I am interested in opening that up, not in an arbitrary way. Here, there's a whole rationale. There are readers out there who will say, and even Catalan specialists, that this is not equivalent. My point is that to avoid these kinds of stylistic flourishes or whatever, I prefer to look at it as inventiveness, something very innovative, is to restrict what a translator can do in a way that is much narrower than what an author of a poem can do in English. And why should we do that? It could be argued that it's not going to make the translation more equivalent or more faithful, if you want to use moralistic terms. You can't say that at this point in the Catalan text, it's standard Catalan, it's not colloquial. Therefore, why should we use a dated colloquialism? It's not in the Catalan. But there's only one response to that, and that is, everything in my translation is not in the Catalan.
Of course.
Because this poet wrote in Catalan, not in English.
Fraser's project seems to particularly invite an interventionist approach. As you point out in the translator's note, the emulative rivalries already at work in ekphrastic poetry are registered in your translation. Further, he invokes Hopper into his poems. He appropriates Hopper's culture, so your use of Hopper's lexicon is a perfect fit. However, are there translation projects for which an interventionist approach is not warranted? Do you ever wish to defer your own interpretation?
This is a great question. I think that people, you know, don't ask me it enough. They tend to dismiss the projects because they say, you know, the refrain is, well, it's not in the source text, so why are you doing it? It's gratuitous. I think the issue for me, and then the more I've translated, you know, the more I've become obsessed with this, the more obvious it's become to me, is that translation is an interpretive act, and that it will not do to say, oh, if you interpret, you're imposing on the source text something that's not there. Translation is an interpretation. It does not give you back the source text. It gives you something else. Even when you look up every word in the source language in a dictionary, that just means you're maintaining a certain kind of equivalence. I am not in favor of rewriting the plots of novels or dropping out subplots or changing endings. There was a time when this was allowed in translation, you know, a couple hundred years ago, you know, a few, 18th century. We don't do that, and I'm not in favor of that. What I am really conscious of is what translation does to the source text, how it displaces the source text, how it creates a ratio of loss and gain, and how to take responsibility for that. And the point for me, I think, finally, is that if you start thinking of translation as an interpretation, then you need to develop a principle of necessity for what you're doing. And that means that's one way to take responsibility for it. Every translator, I think, wants to give the source text a new life in a different language and culture. So how do you construct that afterlife? Weak interpretations won't do it. Someone who comes along and says, I'm going to develop an ultra-faithfulness by adhering as closely as possible, doing a so-called literal translation, may do a translation that's unreadable. So what kind of afterlife is that? The reader is going to throw away the translation. But there's a certain self-delusion involved there, because no translation is literal. All translation is figurative. And the question is deciding what kind of figure you're going to create. Every translation develops a different kind of, you know, interpretation. But the way I want to practice translation is as an experimentalism. My hero is in this, one of my heroes, is Pound.
Okay, as I recall, he did not necessarily consider it essential to actually know the original language.
I don't agree with that.
Okay, good. So yeah, exactly. What license is one to be experimentalist?
I mean, I need to give a sense of what I mean by the experimental, I think. And one way to do that is to talk about what's important in Pound. I mean, there's a lot of crazy stuff in Pound that we don't want to, you know, bring back, you know. And I'm not just talking about the obvious stuff, like the anti-Semitism and the sexism. But one of his greatest pieces about translation is an essay called Guido's Relations, where after, you know, translating Guido Cavalcanti, you know, the 13th century Italian poet, Dolce Stil Novisti, for some 20 years, he sits back and, you know, lays out his whole program. What he lays out there is a view of translation where the translator doesn't simply pay attention to the relationship between the translation and the source text, but the relationship between the translation and the receiving situation. Or even more precisely, the relationship between the translation and the linguistic patterns and literary traditions in the receiving situation. So for Pound, the question is, in this particular essay, not simply, you know, how do I translate Cavalcanti accurately, but what do I translate him into to get certain linguistic and cultural values that I see in the Italian texts. And he comes up with some interesting stuff. He says, we can't translate this 13th century Italian poet into 13th century English, because the English at this time were primitive. They were walking around unbreeched, he says, wearing war paint. Okay, they were really primitive. But if we imagine what he calls a pre-Elizabethan English, that's the term he uses, when writers, he says, were still interested in clarity and precision, we can get something that will help us to bring Cavalcanti into English. As opposed to, he says, magniloquence and the thundering phrase. The thing about this kind of approach is that he wants to build a stylistic analogy into the source text. It's about creating intertexts. So you don't just translate into English. You have at your disposal a broad stylistic repertoire. Exactly. And he essentially was translating Cavalcanti into poets like Sir Thomas Wyatt, that kind of pre-Elizabethan English. But also, he was a great admirer of Gavin Douglas, a Scots translator, the first translation of the Aeneid into Scots English, into English at all, a complete translation, was done by Gavin Douglas. So think about late 15th century. And his Cavalcanti, I mean, he did multiple drafts of his translations, and there are these weird Scottish words in them. When you look at Pound's translations, one of the things that you become aware of immediately is that they are archaizing. There's a dense archaism. He even invents archaic words, you know, like her word. Toward her. The experimentalism is deciding that you're going to create a stylistic analogy that fits the source text according to your interpretation of the source text. Pound, however, I mean, this has to be immediately qualified, because Pound didn't think that the Cavalcanti, his text, the Italian text, could support multiple and possibly conflicting interpretations. He thought that these values of clarity and precision were inherent in the text. He was not entirely aware, or did not show his awareness in this essay, that what he was doing was essentially a modernist canon formation. And when he was dismissing the thundering phrase and magniloquence, he was doing a kind of modernist critique of Christopher Marlowe, right? The thundering phrase, you know, is this the face who launched a thousand ships, right? Blank verse, and Milton. He chose to translate Cavalcanti and translated him into pre-Elizabethan English as a kind of act of canon reformation. That was his modernist project. What interests me as a translator is what I'm calling this translation experimentalism. What would happen if we approached source text by thinking not how we're going to match what's going on in the source text in some kind of seamless equivalence, but if we thought, okay, what resources in English can we use to translate this? That would force us to become more aware of our Englishes, okay, of the stylistic repertoire, of the traditions that feed into our current situation, as well as the variety of styles and discourses and genres being mobilized today. This became, you know, a kind of project for me, and I translated a 19th century Italian writer of Gothic tales into an amalgam of, you know, Mary Shelley and Poe and Bram Stoker.
So this was the process of translating Iu Tarchetti, right? And after you had translated him, you realized that one of the stories you translated wasn't actually an Iu Tarchetti original, but was a translation of a Mary Shelley piece. So Iu Tarchetti had been the invisible translator. And the lexicon you chose to source from had been rather spot on.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. I was like channeling Mary Shelley. It was weird. I found this out completely by accident and then went and, you know, got her story, of course, and looked not simply at the Italian against her English. It was a very close translation. But I looked at my English against her English. Mm. And it was uncanny, mm-hmm. with the resemblances, because my strategy was archaizing. I decided that I would not translate Tarchetti into current standard English. This yeah. was a late 19th century Italian writer. Mm-hmm. He should not look as if he just wrote it today. Mm-hmm. I cultivated a Gothic style. Mm-hmm. So I built, you know, a lexicon from reading and translated with the Oxford English Dictionary in my lap and all of that and verified things. There was plenty of current standard English. I didn't do something that was so dense as to be unreadable. I wanted to give my reader pleasure. It did, I have to say, because horror fans who read everything got off on this and, you know, it was reviewed, for instance, in a magazine called Necrophile. With necrophile with an F.
Yeah. Okay.
And the reviewer said that there was nothing. Okay, I remember the reviews, right? The good ones. I remember the bad ones too, sadly. But the reviewer said there was nothing so esoteric here that, you know, you couldn't appreciate it. The New Yorker really got the experiment. They used the metaphor. The translation evokes a style never heard before. A mixture of northern shadows and southern shimmer. This person saw immediately
yeah.
what I was up to, mm-hmm. and that was the idea, to do something never heard in English. Mm-hmm. All the characters' names were Italian, of course, mm-hmm. or German or whatever. I mean, I retained all that. Nothing was anglicized. There were Italian place names, and all the themes mm-hmm. were late 19th century Italian. Mm-hmm. But there was this, you know, English Gothic style mm-hmm. mixed with some current standard mm-hmm. stuff, so it wasn't impenetrable. Mm-hmm. And I learned that from Powell. But that became, you know, a kind of way of thinking about translations. With Antonia Pozzi, the early 20th century Italian woman poet, I read the poems and they evoked in me a U.S. women's poetic idiom, H.D., Lori Niedecker, Mina Loy, I mean, yeah. these poets. And that became the source of my intertext. Mm-hmm. Here I deviated from the line breaks of the Italian, because the Italian is drawing on certain late 19th, early 20th century symbolist mm-hmm. poetries. Pozzi was not simply a modernist. She was very much appreciated by Eugenio Montale, for instance, you know, so she was plugged into that. But she was also a kind of late romantic. My translations are more modernizing as opposed to some other ones that have been done. So this is something, you know, that I've done with poems, but also with prose. You know, I've translated noir from Italian and essentially assimilated the text to the American hard-boiled tradition. Not arbitrarily, because mm-hmm. there are obscenities, there are various colloquial clipped forms in the Italian. I would, you know, soak up Jim Thompson and mm-hmm. writers like that and translate the Italian noir. But this goes back to your question. I mean, do I do projects or can I? Or what about projects where you don't build an intertext with such a kind of deliberate project? And, you know, I mean, I've done those too. I think that in these cases, the intertext is just not as noticeable. But the intertext is always there.
Right.
As soon as you pick words in the translating language, mm-hmm. you are referring to previous patterns of linguistic use. Mm-hmm. So previous speech acts, maybe genres, mm-hmm. discourses. So the intertext is always there. It depends, I guess, on how pronounced it is. So.
Sure. Well, and one of the benefits, as I see them, of a pronounced interpretation is that you highlight the fact a work is a translation and not just the original, but in English.
Yes. Yes. And this is something that I'm keen on, although it's a dangerous kind of move. It's risky. And one of the things I admire, and, you know, my mentors taught me how to do this, you know, pushed me in that direction, and it's something that's very hard to do, and that is to give a kind of immediate readerly pleasure by creating a translation where the reader doesn't have the awareness of reading a translation, loses that, and instead feels as if, you know, he or she is reading the source text, an illusion of transparency in that sense.
So you invoke that sometimes, or you try to...
Well, yeah, I mean, but I think there are different ways to do it. Yeah. I mean, the dominant way, if I could use this term, you know, dominant, is to do that by writing a kind of common denominator language, which again I would describe primarily as current standard English in our case. That edits out the non-standard forms, you know, on a routine basis. I mean, this is what gets blue penciled by copy editors, so that readers get used to reading the most familiar form of the translating language, which is actually quite narrow. And the more familiar it is, the more invisible it becomes as language.
Right.
So when you translate a realistic novel that way, the translation supports the realist illusion, the illusion of reality that's already being effected in the source text. So, you know, I want to give readers that kind of readerly pleasure. I want to expand the parameters of the language. I want to look at translation as a writerly practice, where the interpretation that the translator inscribes mm-hmm. is done at the level of the lines, performed mm-hmm. in the strong sense of performative, Austin's performative. Mm-hmm. You do the source text at the level of the line. You're not doing the source text, though. You're doing an interpretation of the source text. Mm-hmm. But instead of doing it in commentary, where you have a certain amount of freedom to structure your paragraphs and to sequence them, mm-hmm. you got to do it through the words you choose mm-hmm. and how you construct your sentences and where you do the line breaks in mm-hmm. your poems. So the problem for me is always this question of fluency, or kind of readerly fluency. I'm not against it. I want to give it to readers. The problem is that fluency has been described or enforced by editors, reviewers, readers with such narrowness mm-hmm. that you can't use contractions, you know, in translation. You can't leave the G off of ing words if you want to signal, you know, a different register, a dialect. So
for us, it was must use contractions. Nevertheless, I can completely understand the difficulty and precariousness of achieving an experimentalist fluency. And with this in mind, perhaps we can return to your Fides translations. Would you pick one more poem to read from Edward Hopper?
So this is the self-portrait. It's on the cover, 1925 to 1930. On the spot where I write all this hodgepodge of verses stands Edward Hopper. In fact, who engenders them, and who, neatly transcending space-time, sends me the signals. His self-portrait creates, as would bring delight to Borges the fantasist, a mirror that reproduces not so much the painter's face as the static reflection of my image. Make no bones about it. Hopper and I form one single person. His pose, relaxed and sober, the curves of his face, the surfeit of enchantment that shaped his eyes, without a doubt, show my concerns. If Goethe was reincarnated in Kafka, Hopper, in a transmigration most apt, pulled it off in me. And thus, assuming a poet's body, he will succeed in extending his artistic legacy in time. In the end, only the word remains, poetry. The man in the picture no longer is that painter, thin as a sliver of onion, who came to Europe young to break the ice, but the married painter, his life settled, who will exhibit his personal world profusely, reflecting cities, landscapes, women. I'm just trying to paint myself, he said. You're off the track to see representations of North America, where what really stirs is the agitation of human solitude, where we intuit the fears, obsessions, anxieties, dilemmas or states of mind of the artist, and Jo appears, the omnipresent wife. Like the framed painting, the scads of windows and doors are mirrors, too. I'm just trying to paint myself. Don't poets express their own thoughts? with all and sundry condemned to be a signal thing, he and I were fused in a living creature. His anxieties and states of mind are mine, and mine, in the same breath, belong to everybody in the light of the same moon all over the world. The end always gets me because it suddenly he takes this universal stand. And this is written in Catalan. This is a Catalan poet.
And before he's the Kafka.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, all these canonical writers.
Here's Ernest Fedez reading the original poem.
Autorretrat, 1925-1930. On escric tot aquest assortiment de versos, hi ha de fet l'Edward Hopper que els engendra i que, boi transcendint l'espai-temps, ve a donar-me les consignes. El seu autorretrat és, com li agradaria al fantasista Borges, un mirall que reprodueix no tant el rostre del pintor com el reflex estàtic de la meva imatge. Podem ben creure-ho. Hopper i jo formem una sola persona. El seu posat tranquil i seriós, les corbes de la cara o els tits d'embadalir-se que s'han fet els seus ulls, sense cap dubte, m'incumbeixen. Si Goethe es reencarna en Kafka, Hopper, en una transmigració plena d'encert, ho feu en mi, i així, prenent el cos d'un poeta, aconseguirà que el seu llegat artístic es prolongui en el temps. Al final, només resta la paraula, la poesia. L'home del quadre ja no és aquell pintor prim com un tel de ceba que va venir de jove a Europa a trencar el glaç, sinó el pintor casat, de vida estable, que mostrarà el seu món personal reflectint profusament ciutats, paisatges, dones. No faig, va dir, sinó pintar-me a mi mateix. R, qui veu representacions d'Amèrica del Nord on de debò bateguen els tràfecs de la solitud humana, on intuïm les pors, obsessions, neguits, dilemes o estats d'ànim de l'artista, i hi apareix la Jou, l'omnipresent esposa. Com la pintura emmarcada, també les abundants finestres i portes són miralls. No faig, sinó pintar-me a mi mateix. No expressen els poetes el seu pensament propi? Condemnat tot a ser una sola cosa, en un ésser vivent van fondre'ns ell i jo. Els seus neguits o estats d'ànim són meus, i a la vegada els meus són de tots a la llum d'una mateixa lluna arreu del món.
That was Ernest Fedez reading Self-Portrait 1925 to 1930 from Edward Hopper. Before that, Larry Venuti read his translation of the poem. Larry, in a project like this, where does your role as a translator end and your role as a translation theorist begin?
I could not have done this project if I were not deeply interested in translation theory or in literary and cultural theory generally. Although I consider this, you know, poetry, it's translation practice. What makes it intelligible for me and worth doing, the way I've constructed the so-called necessity that I try to construct when developing a project, fundamentally is a theoretical basis.
And what's at stake, or what are the risks of not translating with a theoretical basis?
Poet translators, or translators who look at themselves because they translate poetry as poets, there's a sense of impressionism about their work, and they're not really able to talk about their work to the different constituencies who need it, who use it. And this includes, of course, academics. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is this antipathy toward the academy. But the fact is that the academy is turning out the next generation of readers of translations. Mm-hmm. The academy is not innocent in this, because in the academy, translation is marginalized. And academics who are utterly dependent on translations for their teaching and research, especially in the U.S., don't know how to talk about translations as translations.
Exactly.
You know, we can't let them get away with it, on mm-hmm. the one hand. But on the other hand, translators need to be able to talk about their work to academics, but also to readers. And readers need to have more than just metaphors about translation. We're in a moment when there is a greater consciousness about, you know, foreign literatures, foreign cultures, for a variety of reasons. A greater consciousness about the global dominance of English, possibly because of the waning of American hegemony around the world. But, you know, whatever the reasons, we're at a moment where we need to think about translation in much more incisive, much more sophisticated ways, in ways that are not impressionistic, not, as I tend to call them, belletristic. Mm-hmm. I don't want to mix theory and practice in the sense that I look at them as different discourses. Mm-hmm. However, I do want to acknowledge that there is no practice without theory. Mm-hmm. In my work, I mean, there came a point after translating 5 books, finally, that I got theory. Mm-hmm. I was translating at a certain moment in the 1980s, and I was an academic, and so it was inevitable that I would start thinking about my translations in theoretical terms, which is not to say that in those 5 books I didn't have a theory. Mm-hmm. I just did not articulate it and wasn't called upon until my colleague said, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't be translating, and I had a very immediate reason to articulate it for them, to educate them, and simultaneously myself. So I was, you know, began developing, you know, a whole theoretical discourse about translation.
And on the other side, how efficiently are theorists able to discuss translations if they're not translators?
No, I mean, there is an interest in translation theory in, you know, universities. Mm-hmm. It's emerging in comparative literature. The recent debates, by recent I mean over the past 15, 20 years, right, about world literature, the revival of Goethe's notion of world literature. Most recently in this talk about untranslatability, Barbara Cassan's Dictionary of Untranslatables has created a big stir. The people who are engaged in these debates are not translators. They are comparative literature scholars or foreign language specialists or people interested in literary and cultural studies. However, I am excited that they're taking this interest in translation, even as I want to intervene and say, look, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree here, and untranslatability rests on an assumption about translation which is not tenable. But at least we're developing, we're getting to a point where we can have a conversation about translation in universities, and that is something new.
It's exciting. Before we conclude, would you tell me what you're working on now?
After, you know, translating, you know, over 30 years, most of my projects have not been inspired, if I could use that word, by a publisher's commission. They've been developed. Mm-hmm. And I had to do that because, you know, as a young translator, I wasn't getting commissions. I mean, they would go to the elder translators in the field, the William Weavers and Brian Swans and Ruth Feldman. So if I wanted to translate, I had to, you know, decide what I was going to do and suffer a lot of rejection. A new project is always that. It's about building a readership, getting publishers interested, and so forth. So this project is no different, even though it involves a canonical writer in Catalan, who for the most part has been neglected by translators. There are a lot of reasons for this, I think, and mainly, though, because he's difficult. Now, he's a writer who died in 1987, but was a major figure, a modernist, who signed his work, J.V. Foch. Began publishing in the 1920s and has had some translations in English by David Rosenthal, who I mentioned earlier. So what I've decided to do is to launch Foch by translating early prose poems from a big project that he imagined, although he didn't complete it. He called this project, in English I would call it, Daybook 1918. And he imagined a diary-like sequence of prose poems, one for each day of the year. He wound up writing only about 200 or so. Very interesting, stylistically, you know, varied over, you know, the decades of his career. I'm focusing on the early ones, where Foch is very much in touch. And, you know, the first book was published in 1927, but he began writing it, as the title of this project suggests, in 1918. It was his first publication in a magazine. He began channeling the European avant-gardes, was in touch with, you know, Cubism and Surrealism, the Dada poets and Futurists. Because he was a minor writer, he would gravitate toward, you know, major literatures and make something quite new.
Sounds interesting. Could we hear an excerpt?
What I could share with you is some excerpts from a sequence called Notes on the Sea. So this is number one. The surprise occurred when, after spending much effort to remove the scenery where various maritime motifs had been painted, we discovered the mysterious corral of the black horses. Come nightfall, they wander the beach by the thousands, a star on their foreheads. 2. Wearing a grotesque pasteboard nose, firmly fastened, I was strolling along the quay with an imposing dictionary of synonyms beneath my arm. The boatman had me sail far out to sea, whether or not I fancied it. He was an Anglican priest, and he wanted to show me how the most beautiful miracles happened on the watery main. Upon noticing my arbitrary nose, however, he had the elegance to don his. Then he told me, emphatically, that only the vanity of men causes them to call our planet Earth, in the human scheme of things, whereas God and the saints call it sea in their eternal language, and the Earth on our planet was only an accident, a transitory phenomenon. Men, he told me, are the pigeon excrement of the sea. For my boatman, the great unknown among men was a spherical fishbowl wandering through celestial space for the diversion of the angels. 3. The sea that morning was a solid rectangle, colorless and transparent as crystal. On its surface stood celluloid figures, strange and sui generis, projecting themselves obliquely in long, immeasurable shadows shaped like cones and cylinders. The fishermen, after recovering from their surprise, affirmed that they were the skeletons of stars expelled from the depths of the sea when that phenomenon was produced. 4. Wearing black frock coats and top hats, as well as black gloves, the three horsemen gesticulated comically before the orange-colored sea. When they bumped into me, they recoiled in admiration. Immediately taken by surprise, I asked them with precipitate emotion, "Are you here as well?" And we burst into mad laughter. Then I dashed off to throw on a black coat, top hat, and gloves, and with coal I drew 3 wide wrinkles in my forehead. On the far shore, way over on the far shore, we remembered, with gestures that were at once theatrical and symmetric, the other orange sea, where on an unspecifiable day, all 4 of us also bumped into each other, dressed identically, way over on the far shore. On the far shore, likewise, with raucous laughter, we endeavored to remember, standing before the country with the orange sea, which century it was, when all 4 of us once discussed which planet contains the sea, where the 3 of you and I, all in black and laughing, once strained to remember. 5. As the ball comes to an end, sky and sea form a single darkness. The last star founders on a frightening reef, and at the line of the horizon, a vague phosphorescence lingers from the arabesque of stony coral, so monstrously enormous. Between sea and sky lies nothing but Gertrudis's red stockings, hanging solitary, like a scrap of an ancient flag, from the mast of a serpent ship commanded by Oscar, the famous Viking. 6. From afar, everyone shouts, "The sea! The sea!" But when they stand before it, they are hushed for hours on end. Today, a multitude of men and women, naked as the sea itself, were defying it with boisterous laughter. They thought their brown skin would prove to be an aphrodisiac to the sea, arousing its double hermaphroditic passion. But the sea modestly withdrew beneath its golden mantle, where the captive shadows of the multitude weave with vague, vainly obscene images, an irregular fringe.
You've been listening to the Circumference podcast series. I'm your host, Montana Ray. I'd like to say thank you to Susan Bernofsky, thanks to Ernest Fidesz, and a huge thank you to Lawrence Fidesz.
Per ferides brullant i embrutint la roba se sentien cridar a les víctimes boges per la por i el dolor. Pietat, pietat.
No em mateu, jo tinc dos fills i
jo té una pregària i per l'ànima d'un mort a Siris ja tenen plata. Gran Joan Serra, avui ja no ha tingut sort, de soldats l'han agafat i ara res d'entre barrots. I tothom de bon matí
l'alta forca i de fallar així m'encor.